Hello, my name is like Bambi, and okay, I am blonde. Like, people think that just because I am blonde that I am, like, stupid. That is, like, so untrue. I, like, graduated from high school and everything, and I'm, like, intelligent, articulate, and I have a vocabulary as big as, like, whatever. And as for all this talk about sex, I do not have sex with just anybody. They have to be men. And not like the whole football team either, just the starters. So before you go around saying bad things about blondes like me, you should like find out more about the person inside. Like, not the stuff inside a person, you know, like your guts and stuff. That would be so grody.
There are millions of blondes across the country.
Ew, who even wants to think about that?
And the numbers continue to grow.
Like, what were we talking about?
Please, help them.
I'm sorry, I am like totally spaced here.
A message from the National Institute of the Blonde. Venice Beach, California, 60609.
Like, are you still going to pay me for this? Because my credit card is, like, totally maxed out, and I could really use the money, you know?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're listening to Eric Egan's, who is a TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. And he's talking about how media uses the fear and prejudices of their viewers to garner a larger audience.
Any more questions? Yeah. Fellow right
there. Your analysis of the re-election of Barack Obama in light of your topic, mm-hmm. I mean, is it a signal that people are paying more attention to social media than to the cable outlets?
No, unfortunately.
Of course, MSNBC is ascending, so.
No, unfortunately. I actually think it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2014, and we'll see whether we saw a landmark change in the electorate or whether we have two electorates. Ezra Klein talked about this actually on MSNBC, and I thought it was an interesting idea. When we have a presidential election, especially a presidential election involving Barack Obama, right, more young people come out, more people of color come out, and they vote for the Democrats. One of the reasons why a lot of the predictions for the election were off is that people assumed that those groups would not come out for the Democrats in the same numbers that they did in 2008, and what happened is they came out even more. Right, so they did better with women. They had the young people that they had 4 years ago. They had Hispanics. They had black people. And then all of a sudden, all of the predictions were off because everybody showed up the same way they did 4 years ago, and some of them showed up even more. Now the question is, when we have an off-year election where Barack Obama is not on the ballot, will those same people show up to vote? If they don't, then the people who in 2010 elected the House of Representatives that we have now will be the people who are voting, and they'll be older, they'll be whiter, right? So we'll see. You know, I think 20 that we have now will be the people who are voting, and they'll be older, they'll be whiter, right? So we'll see. You know, I think 2014 is going to tell us a lot. We may have a country where we have two different electorates, and, you know, if you're running in a presidential election, you're facing a much more diverse and a much younger electorate than you would face at an off-year election when people, frankly, just don't pay attention.
So I think you addressed this in your book, but I was wondering how this larger media discourse about the changing demographics of America, about what will happen, you know, when whites become a minority, right? There's been so much coverage about the Hispanic population becoming
right.
The new majority. I wondered how that would complicate, you know, that you hypothesize. How are those discussions taking place in the media? How do you think, sort of projecting into the future, it might complicate our discussions of race?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I was, when I gave my talk at a class earlier today, I had a student from Costa Rica come up to me. And he and I talked about how Hispanics and Latinos are the most underrepresented minority right now. I just did a story where I looked at the percentages of characters in scripted television and assign them by race. So, you know, what percentage are white, what percentage are non-white Hispanic, what percentage are Asian and black. And Hispanics, I think, were at 5%, even though there's 16% of the population, non-white Hispanics. There's no other group that's underrepresented to that level. So I think what we're going to hit is a time when there's no ethnic group that is a majority in the U.S. Once Hispanics grow enough, we'll reach a point where no one really has a majority. But that doesn't speak to who has power. And white males will still control corporate power in this country. They'll still run the movie studios, they'll still run the television, they'll still run the radio, they'll still run the newspaper industry, they'll still run the magazine industry, right? So what white males think is important will still have more weight because they'll still control a lot of those institutions. And in fact, we saw that in South Africa where we had, 23, 25 million black people and a much smaller number of white South Africans, but because they controlled the economy and they controlled all the important industry, they controlled the country. So, yes. I feel like Oprah.
Yes.
And only people of a certain age will get that joke.
I'm interested in how you view Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert as a media critic. We have a lot of discussion in classes here about how he claims he's a comedian.
Right.
But there are people, and we've even had polls that have shown, who think otherwise.
Right, right. That's his standard response. I'm just a comedian. I'm just a court jester. But then you have all these people who say they get their news from the Daily Show. Well, one thing I will say about him and Stephen Colbert is I think they are the most brilliant media critics working in media today. They just have an unerring ability to find the weak spots of media. That bit that Stewart did about how cable channels would say, we'll leave it there. You know, they get to the end of a segment, oh, we got to leave it there. You're a 24-hour news channel. What do you mean you got to leave it there? Just come back and keep talking about it. You know? No, we got to leave it there. So I really love the way they dissect media. One of the things I noticed about The Daily Show, though, is that I really think leading up to the last election and after the last election, they have become more partisan, if you can believe it or not. I think at one point, Jon Stewart seemed to feel an obligation to make sure that he was taking shots at the other guys, at the Democrats. And then at some point, it felt like things changed on the show. And I'm a regular viewer of the show. I watch it almost every night when it's in new episodes. And I don't know, you know, we hear now that he's going to be off directing a movie during the summer, and that he's going to take a hiatus from the show, and John Oliver is going to host it for a while. So maybe it's just a sign that maybe he is a little tired and wants to try some other things. But I felt at some point, I used to defend The Daily Show against people who said that it was just in the tank for the Democrats. And I said that even though he has a set of values where you can tell he believes in the Democratic message more, he still gives everybody a hard time equally. You know, when the Democrats do something dumb, he'll talk about that too. But I felt like that changed a bit. And I noticed the last interview that he did, I even did a blog post about this and wrote about this in the newspaper. He did an interview with Barack Obama right before the election. And it was essentially a softball interview. He didn't challenge him very much. And then I went back and I watched the interview that he did with Barack Obama before the 2008 election. Or not before the 2008 election. I think it was before the 2010 elections. That's what it was. Before the 2010 elections when he was president. And he was on him. You know, he was basically the disappointed liberal challenging Barack Obama to say, how come you didn't live up to these promises that you made us? And the difference to me was surprising. And I felt like, you know, this is a guy who does not want the president to lose this election. That's what I was seeing last year. And I felt like, you know, that's the problem. And the other thing with Colbert and The Daily Show is that they don't have to show the other side, right? They don't have to be fair. And that's what makes journalism boring sometimes, or it's not as hard-hitting as you want, or as it doesn't get in people's faces. That whole, oh, we got to be fair, you know? And that, I think, is always going to put us one step behind the satirists, because they can just say whatever they want and make it kind of look like they're being fair, but we have to actually be fair, so.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun. Shine on, you crazy diamond. Now used in the light.
Sorry. I just wanted to ask how you think reality television shows fit into some of the media that you're talking about in race baiting.
Oh, thank you so much. I didn't even give you any money for that plug. But yes, there is a chapter in the book about reality television. Obviously, reality television, I think, is a way for TV producers to present some really awful stereotypes and pretend that they are showing real life. The first thing you should understand about any kind of television is that you do not see a second on a professional television show that you are not meant to see. Yes, reality shows too. Yes, reality shows too. Some of them are as scripted as any entertainment product, right? So when you see something on a reality show, you're meant to see it, and you're meant to see it the way you're seeing it. So I think a lot of times these reality shows, like I just did a big column for the newspaper about how I think reality shows stereotype white people in ways that they could never get away with if they did it with Hispanic people or if they did it with black people. If they did a show like Myrtle Manor, but they set it in the hood, in the projects, and they were showing a guy with 10 children, a black man with 10 children, it would get shut down in a minute. But, you know, white folks don't react that way when their own stereotypes are used to fuel TV shows that depict them. So, you know, Duck Dynasty and Myrtle Manor and Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. Oh, my God. I can't believe whoever runs the child abuse agency wherever they live should lose their job, because I would be on their front doorstep every day just documenting what's going on. You know, just, okay, they made her go on Good Morning America at 6 a.m. Okay, they fed her Mountain Dew. You know, just keep a list. And once it gets to a certain point, just shut it down, man. Just take her into custody and it's over, you know. But to be serious, I really do think that these reality shows, like the producers are able to say, we're just showing real people, right? We're just showing real people. We're not satirizing the South by having somebody with thick accents and then putting subtitles like you can't, like they're speaking some other language. Come on, it's a Southern accent, you know. But you touched the nerve, I guess. Sorry. Yeah.
In terms of the black stereotypes and white stereotypes that they portray in reality TV shows, what do you think the difference is between the sticking power of white stereotypes and the sticking power of black stereotypes is in today's media?
I think what happens is that a lot of times white people don't think they have a racial culture, you know? So they don't, there isn't a response to the stereotypes in the same way that there's a response to stereotypes about black people and people of color. Because what I always say is that the best way to subjugate a people is to make them subjugate themselves. Make them keep themselves in line. And I may get in trouble for saying this, but I feel like women in America are the best example of that. Over the years, we have taught women to limit their own thinking about what they can achieve, with or without a man. And so we don't have to pay women less, because they'll do it themselves, right? And for people of color, that's happened for many, many years. We had many, many years of awful limiting stereotypes that taught everybody, including other people of color, that their options were limited. And now, at least we recognize that that's a mechanism of oppression, and we got to fight it. But I think white people don't see it that way yet, you know? So we can have this litany of stereotypes about working class white people, especially Southerners, that are just circulating in media, and Duck Dynasty gets these huge ratings. And even the people on the show know what they're doing. You can look at some of the people in the show, and they're like, they're like winking at the camera. Yeah, yeah. You know, I wouldn't really be dressed like this, but hey, they're paying me $800,000, you know? So, you know, at some point I think people will get tired of it, and enough people will talk about what's happening that it'll get exposed. But right now I just think we're used to seeing some things in racial terms, and we're not so used to seeing other things in racial terms. And I think that explains the difference in how people are reacting. But stereotypes are enduring. You know, they're really hard to step away from. And so as much as we know about how stereotyping and prejudice works, we still see a lot of it involving people of color, too. And we see a lot of black folks consuming those messages, watching those shows and enjoying those shows, even though some of the images in them are really damaging. So, yeah, we got somebody here? And let me know when I run out of time, because I'll talk all day, man. I will.
Most of the discussion is focused on TV, but some of the same forces behind these channels are now venturing into print and, that area of journalism. What do you think about the future with that?
I don't know. You know, I think print's challenges are much different. Print's challenges are figuring out how to make money with an outdated and constantly disintegrating economic system, you know, money-making system. So I don't know that I see the problems that I see with stereotyping in print are problems that I've always seen. You know, we cover race like an episodic event rather than covering it regularly. So if you watch the nightly news, or if you pick up a newspaper, you're always going to see a report on the stock market. You're always going to hear about what Congress was up to. You're always going to hear about what the president did. But when we do stories about race, it's a big 12-part series that we spent 2 years working on. And here it is. For a week, we're going to talk about race. And then we don't talk about race again for another month or 2 months or 2 years, right? And we do that with poverty, too. And so I think some of the problems with stereotyping in print, you know, is the same thing. Now, we do see online, you know, these outlets transferring. You know, Fox News's approach is now being mirrored on Breitbart.com and the Drudge Report and Newsbusters.org. And, you know, MSNBC's sort of answer to that is also, you know, we see that on the Huffington Post, or we see that, you know, on Media Matters. You know, so that is migrating online as well. But I think print's problem is that it feels like old news. It's like asking people when the next buggy whip is coming out. You know, it's like, you know, sad to say, they're not making a lot of them anymore. So, okay, last question.
Yeah. So Eric, I wanted to ask you about, you know, this whole genre of allowing citizens to comment, right, on YouTube videos or news stories and so on. And there's also an IU alum called Jamie Loke, who's a professor at University of Oklahoma. Mm. And when I wondered what you thought. One of the arguments she has made is that this sort of theater of citizen democracy is allowing people to say incredibly racist things.
Oh, sure.
In online spaces.
Sure.
And so, you know, the people who could not respond to MASH, maybe some of them shouldn't have. You know what I mean?
They couldn't do it.
I wondered what you thought about, you know, what this is doing for race relations and racism, you know, in the sphere of, you know,
right,
the supposed opening up, right,
sure,
of media space.
Well, what I think is you can't just focus on commenting, right? Because commenting is just one part of the online experience. And commenting, you can comment without attaching your identity to it. So people say a lot of ugly, awful stuff because they want to be provocative, or because they know nobody will hold them accountable for it, or they just like hurting people or whatever, right? And they can do it because they're anonymous. But what social media and online also allows is that people can find each other who normally would never find each other, right? So if you are a biracial, one-armed soccer enthusiast living in Indianapolis, you can find other one-armed biracial soccer enthusiasts all over the world. And there may only be 50 of you. But you can all get together on that Facebook page, and all of a sudden, you're united. And you know there's a bunch of other people like there who are just like you. And you also can trade ideas about your identity in the world, or, you know, how people stereotype one-armed biracial soccer enthusiasts. You know, you can interact, you know. And what I like about the social media world, too, is it mobilizes people. Right. So I was talking to Clay Shirky for the book. And those who don't know Clay Shirky, he's a professor at NYU who is just really ahead of the curve in terms of the effect of online media on social groups and, you know, how all this stuff works in terms of media and society and people. And one of the things he pointed out was we had this situation where the Hunger Games movie came out And a lot of fans of the Hunger Games book suddenly realized that there were characters in that book who were black in the movie that they didn't know were black in the book. And so they started posting all this racist stuff on Twitter, like, why'd they cast that so-and-so as so-and-so, right? And then all of a sudden, this wave of people descended. The whole wrath of the Twitter sphere descended on these people to the point where a lot of these accounts that had posted the original Twitter messages are now defunct. People have walked away from them. And so what happened was, even though Twitter allowed these people to make these comments, they also found out that there was this whole universe of Twitter users who were not going to put up with that. And they made it plain very quickly, right? So that's the yin and the yang of where we are today with online media. And that's why I don't believe in shutting down comment sections, even though they can be problematic, even though they're hard to keep control of, even though people kind of go nuts on them. It's just another part of this open discussion that we're having, integrating social media and the freedom that social media brings. And I think it's important for journalism organizations especially to say, we're going to be open-minded to that, and we're going to be as inclusive in that space as we possibly can. So.
He loves only gold. That's all, folks.